Hello, everybody, and welcome to Practitioners Will Transform the World. I'm Terry Patton, and I'm delighted to be with you. This event is an exclusive virtual workshop for people engaged in the 8-session course, Integral Spiritual Practice, that I teach. I am delighted to be welcoming two towering figures in the field of consciousness and transformation who I'm blessed to call my dear friends, Gene Houston and Ken Wilber. The way this is going to unfold is, first I'll introduce you to Ken and Gene, and then I'll introduce our topic. And then I'll invite Gene and Ken to each offer a short teaching on this topic, and if to the degree that that's congruent, offer pointing out instructions or experiential processes. And then once we've really set the stage, I'll offer an orienting statement myself, and the three of us will have a conversation designed to help you more deeply grapple with this opportunity and challenge and grow and deepen in relation to this vital dimension of our historical moment and our personal lives and practice. Dr. Gene Houston is a scholar, philosopher, and researcher in human capacities and one of the foremost visionary women of our time, a truly towering figure in the transformation of human culture for almost 50 years and one of the principal founders of the Human Potential Movement. A powerful and dynamic speaker, she holds conferences and seminars with social leaders, educational institutions, and business organizations worldwide. She has worked intensively in over 40 cultures in 102 countries, helping diverse peoples enhance and deepen their own unique leadership. In other words, she's got a lot of experience in the very topic we're considering today. Since her childhood, Jean has worked closely or connected with some of the leading figures of our time, including Helen Keller, Teilhard de Chardin, Margaret Mead, Martin Luther King, Mother Teresa, Jimmy and Rosalind Carter, and Bill, and especially Hillary Clinton. In 1965, along with her husband, Dr. Robert Masters, she founded the Foundation for Mind Research, and they co-authored the book Mind Games, celebrated by John Lennon's song by the same name. She's worked extensively as an advisor to several UN agencies and is a past president of the Association for Humanistic Psychology. She's also the founder and principal teacher since 1982 of her own mystery school dedicated to teaching history, philosophy, the new physics, psychology, anthropology, myth, and the many dimensions of human potential. She's also pioneered what she calls social artistry and conducts trainings in her school for social artistry as well. She's a prolific writer, the author of 26 books, including A Passion for the Possible Human, and Jump Time. Welcome, Gene. Ken Wilber is one of the most brilliant synthetic thinkers and communicators of our time, the author of a simple integral vocabulary called AQUAL that can form the basis, supplemented with some additional key distinctions of a vocabulary that can keep us from getting lost in the big story. He's fashioned a few crucial advances in our navigational equipment, sextants and compasses that can help us navigate the vast crossing that lies before us. His philosophy, sometimes called the integral operating system, confers a kind of second sight, a psychoactive vision logic that enables us to feel into the implications of vast abstract philosophical ideas, but then enables us to navigate the interface between our interior and exterior territory at a whole new level. It enables us to see the game at a higher level and thus play at a higher level, a level from which we can help this worn-out game relax and open and transform. Not only that, but most blessedly, it's a view that can be navigated from the heart, by the heart. One way to put it is that he has brilliantly beat the scientific reductionists at their own game. He's cut out a vast swath of territory for spirit, for God. You might say that he's cleared the metaphysics out of the way and made it new kind of rational mysticism possible. However you view it, his work creates a structure for mutual respect among our post-postmodern tribal factions, so our propensity for cultural warfare doesn't have to cause us to lose it and blow the graceful transition that I think we're all aiming for. Ken is the world's leading integral philosopher, the author of over 20 books, including Integral Spirituality, A Brief History of Everything, Sex, Ecology, and Spirituality, No Boundary, and Grace and Grit. He's the founder of Integral Institute, the Journal of Life, Incorporated, the Integral Spiritual Center. Revered as the Einstein of consciousness, he's the only living philosopher I know of to have his collected works published during his lifetime. And he's a dedicated, lifelong spiritual practitioner who's actually put in thousands of hours on his meditation cushion. So his synthesis of knowledge is always lit with the inner light of gnosis, uniting the eye of flesh, the eye of mind, and the eye of spirit. He joins us this morning from his loft in Denver, Colorado. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you, Terry.
And our topic this morning is how practitioners will transform the world. Some people see spiritual practice as if it's an alternative to practical worldly action. But I see truly integral evolutionary practice as the basis for more enlightened engagement with the world. During a time when the human species is facing problems that clearly can't be resolved with the kind of consciousness that created them, practice, which is the process of cultivating a higher, fuller, deeper, clearer, more transparent consciousness and presence in the world, should be a way to quicken individual growth and to catalyze the emergence of communities of practice who can actually embody new ways of being and help us make a leap to higher levels of participation in life. But that, of course, is a lot easier said than done. So, Gene, can you lead off by giving us a sense of where we are in terms of this topic in historical terms?
Well, thank you so much, Terry. Yes, and I will stutter my and stumble my way through such a question, but I want to thank you for inviting me, and I've enjoyed so much listening to your lectures and the depth of your sensibility, and what an honor it is for the first time, actually, to be on a panel with you, my friend Ken, because you know that you have been a luminous guide and wayfinder for so many of us as you do the deep, deep work of culture and consciousness. And so it's a great honor for me.
The honor's all mine, my friend.
But here we are. We're on the eve of 2012, you know, the mythic year of what? Of what? I mean, radical transition. I mean, what did those old Mayans really know? I'm reminded of that marvelous New Yorker cartoon which shows a couple of old Mayans 1,000 years ago, and you see the pyramid in the background, and one is rolling along a calendar stone, and he says, "I ran out of stone when I got up to 2012. And the other guy says, "Boy, that's going to freak out somebody someday." Anyway, what I have to say is that although there have been many births and deaths and rebirths of civilizations and societies over the last, 5,000 years, I believe that the birth process of this time is far more radical than any previous births of new cultures out of old ones. I mean, for this time, it is the process of getting out of history when its cycles have ended or they've gotten caught or stalemated. We have, you know, you and I both have spoken endlessly about the many seemingly impossible challenges of our time, of which, of course, the greatest is the ecological breakdown. And, of course, the great breakthroughs of people rising up to challenge on a global level the old patterns of the past, because it appears that the Tao, or the organic coding of universal nature, says it's time to jump off into a new dispensation. And what is the modality? I think it is the practices, which we'll get into. And for one thing, weird as it sounds, but predicted for what, the last 100 years or so, the next order may be in part one of bringing mind and soul into further vistas of space and time, or rather into what we would have to think of as deep space and deep time. And I was thinking of looking at this from the perspective of a planetologist, meaning someone who has access to the datum of planetary history from, say, you know, 1,000 planets. And from his perspective, I might see the stages of history as natural developmental phenomenon by a dominant species, or perhaps another planet's, a number of species, but unfolding according to the phases of its maturation. And then at that period in which neither ideology or cultural individuation suffices to sustain the yearning and the development of the species, what I've called jump time is reached. And by jump time, in this case, I mean jumping to one or another kind of transcendence of the local human condition. And thus, I think the chaos at the end of history would be the normal situation that prevails when a species is preparing to depart for the inward dimensions, that balance of mind and nature that can happen, or perhaps even to the stars or other planets or parallel dimensions or possibilities at present undreamed of. So that from the point of view of a planetary fetologist, all of human history then appears as a preparation for one or another kind of transcendence of the order of being that we had known for millennia. Because, yes, the planet is the cradle of humankind, but like all cradles, one cannot remain there forever. I mean, the human, and my old friend Terence McKenna used to talk about this, you know, about the human imagination in conjunction with greed. He didn't talk about that, but certainly with technology, is so potent a force that people cannot remain on the surface of this planet with any kind of safety anymore. I mean, after all, we're now 7 billion people and climbing on a planet that was probably not meant for many more, much more than what? I think the latest thought was about 2 billion. Now, is this a bad thing? No, it may be inevitable. And it may be part of a kind of necessary metabolism of the galaxy. I mean, history then becomes the shadow cast by eschatology. I mean, calling some to be an end and a new beginning that boggles our local mind. And I think that for the last several hundred years, the shockwave of this eschatological calling has been accelerating. And the waves are coming so thick and fast that we're being shaken into the future and even shattered into transcendence. And this is where I think we're going to explore it. Does it have to be a shattering, or can it be a a deep, comprehensive, systemic or metasystemic practices that then lead us to the level of knowledge and being that allow us to be the stewards of the planet, not the destroyer. Now, what are some of these shockwaves? The human imagination, I think it was Jung certainly, many of the archetypal Jungian psychologists like James Hillman, who suggests that it's not that imagination is in us, but that we are spored out of the imaginal or the imaginative base. But it has become so powerful that the only environment possible to it is the vacuum. And it's the vacuum of deep inner or deep outer space. I remember when I was about 19, I was invited to be the only girl attending at Union Theological Seminary the lectures of Paul Tillich, his third volume of his Systematic Theology. And he had a very thick dramatic accent. Won't we find that the vacuum of the Heilsgeschichte? Anyway, so we couldn't figure out what this word vacuum meant. I mean, the womb of a vacuum, who is it? And so we theological students would just gather together. We would, after every class, we would really create our own lexicon of what was the meaning of vacuum, and we were really quite inventive, but we knew we didn't have it. So at the end of the course, they asked me, the young girl, to ask a question, and being 19, I asked a question with eschatology in it, phenomenology, ontology, all in one sentences. And I raised my hand, and Dr. Tillich said, "Yes, Miss Houston." Professor Tillich, "Yes, Miss Houston. What is it, Professor Houston? I mean, Professor? No, that's me. Professor Tillich." I was so confused, and I said, "I forgot my question." And I asked a question, blithering naivety. Professor Tillich, how do you spell walk-woop? "Yes, walk-woop." And on the board, he writes vacuum. And we think, wow, that's it. That's what it's all about. You know, it's all the walk-woop. I mean, when you get all the hard parts of the human being, every human being, and you press them all together, you maybe have a kind of heavy grain of rice. The rest of it is the wok womb. So what's in the wok womb? You know, is it the mind of God? Is the creative principle yearning, evolution yearning at the threshold of space-time to enter? It's all in the wok womb. And we're entering the wok womb of deep inner space and maybe outer space. I mean, we see what has exceeded, a human being has exceeded the Earth environment. I mean, given the quickening occurrence of hurricanes and tornadoes and tsunamis and earthquakes and the inevitable migration of many millions of people away from what the 40% of all cities by the sea. I mean, the next 10 to 50 years is going to change the maps of culture and civilization. And this is where we enter into another order of space-time. We enter into the wok womb. We become the force of nature. We are a new geological force. We are an amalgam of brain and body and prosthesis and computers and social inventions and that's moving with such speed and complexity that some of us will have to move into the galaxy and most of us will have to move into inner space. And it involves a profound transformation in consciousness, which involves a profound series of practices. We're not entering deep space with Flash Gordon or Buck Rogers 1930s consciousness. I mean, maybe it is true that the grace and the depth and the elegance of consciousness required to do what? To join the galactic milieu is of an order of being and knowing that has only been anticipated in some of the great socio-spiritual inventions, such as we have had in our history, and which hopefully, you and I and Terry, we in our own way, we try to lift a small veil in exploring many of these traditions and these inventions, these discoveries, these practices. I maintain we're apart from their benefit to those who practice them. They were trial runs, trial run throughs, trial run gallops for the possible human who would maybe not actually need them for hundreds or even thousands of years. However, the time to use them is now, and the development of these social and spiritual forms taking thousands of years has all led to this moment at the end of history as we've known it, and perhaps in some way that we do not yet understand. History itself is the crucible which maintains sufficient challenge and response within and between cultures so that these social and spiritual realities can be alchemized and brought into form. So I think we are at that point in which maybe it's true, as old Terence said, a fundamental division occurs in the human race. I mean, depending on their proclivities, one group leads for heaven and the other leads for paradise. I mean, those who leave for heaven will be the ones with the heroic sensibility. It gives a whole new twist on the hero's journey. Only they yearn for space and stars and outer challenges, and those who stay, which is most of us, will be the ones who feel the attunement between inner and outer nature, who feel in partnership with the planet and with her interior archetypes and spiritual structures, and that's most of us. So I think it's a question of whether one is a citizen of Gaia or a citizen of the galaxy. But in each, there is required an extraordinary growth in consciousness. Extraordinary growth. I mean, really diving into the wok womb. I mean, reconnecting with the contents of the unconsciousness collectively of our own minds as well as with many of the world's cultural and spiritual discoveries and practices. Because I really do believe that the psychic history of the last 44 years since we first walked on the moon is one in which there has been this vast acceleration of intra-psychic exploration and cross-cultural discovery and integration, and I think it's going to be looked back upon as one of the most phenomenal movements in both personal and global consciousness. I mean, we realized that we were, a term that my husband and I coined, psychonauts as well as astronauts. We have access to the vast domains of our body, mind, soul, that we not only live in the universe, but the universe lives in us. We are perhaps, and this is sheer galloping chutzpah to say it, but we are cosmic agents in a protein-based spacesuit living on one of the most beautiful planets in the galaxy, and gifted with sufficient stress and challenge and art and beauty and love and conflict and war and yearning that allows for the emergence of a consciousness that exists so as to fulfill a destiny larger than our aspirations and surely more complex than our dreams. And that, I believe, is that of the God seed becoming the God self. I mean, partner to creation itself, as my old friend Barbara Marx Hubbard insists. But perhaps it could have only happened when we had taken the first step toward the stars by seeing the Earth from outer space and had touched down on the moon and fulfilled an archetypal dream. One of my jobs in the distant past, because you know, I've been around so long, I've been around since God had baby teeth, but I remember back in the early 70s, you know, when I was asked by some NASA people to help certain astronauts remember what they saw on the moon, and they didn't remember. They were in these huge spaceships, you know, the spaceship within the spaceship, that walking spacesuit. So it was very peripheral, and I, you know, I taught them active imagination, I hypnotized them, I put them in deep trance, nothing worked, I yelled at them, that's the only thing that seemed to work. And finally, Ed Mitchell said, "Gene, you're asking the wrong question. It's not what we saw on the moon that's important, it's what we saw coming back to Earth. Because there she was, our luminous green and blue, shimmering silver planet floating in the womb of the cosmos." And he said, "I felt such nostalgia for what the world could be. Because there were no wars. There was none of the stuff that we see in our newspaper. There it was. And I think something happened. It was like a time release capsule in the collective mind. And I think it served to unlock a deep coding, which is now running, and I suspect maybe running us. I mean, surely, as we all know, shamans and mystics and seers and high creatives, you know, having visions and talking to gods and daimons since the Paleolithic, but lately many have been having dreams or visions of a kind of higher order of culture, of consciousness, of civilization. And maybe it's communicating with us, I mean, interdimensionally and telepathically. Maybe we are in joining from the continents of spirit that have given us the harvest of so many different practices. It may be that we are on the veil, the edge of a whole other order of being. It may be that something that is hardwired into the human psyche is arising. Maybe it masks as angels or archetypes or even ETs so as not to horrify us. I mean, is it the overmind of the species, which may be the highest form of intelligence? I used to walk with an old man I called Mr. Tayer for 3 years because he lived down across the street from me, and he turned out to be Tayer de Chardin. It's all Jean, the newest field. Ah, you know, we are reaching far through the deeper structures of our psyche and the higher form of the intellige, which has put its signature on human history since we were in the primate stage, and now we primates, we are the noosphere," you know, and he was very excited. But maybe it's true. Maybe the noosphere is part of our evolutionary journey, and it's been releasing ideas and images into the stream of history to boost us to higher forms of self-reflection as psychic, pan-psychic or evolutionary psychic enzymes. And our mind, this mind is part of the archetypal structure which bleeds into the psyche. And the place of the so-called gods and the archetypal ideas within us, which then rise to meet it. I mean, be this as it may, it would appear that we're living in a time in which the masks are beginning to fall away. And maybe we were reseeded by God knows who or what when we were monkeys, you know, struggling to get free. And maybe this is what the historical crisis is about. Unnecessary chaos leading to a more highly developed order. It is a birth crisis about the God-seeded monkey becoming an illuminated being. It is a chaotic and turbulent multidimensional metamorphosis. There's been, as far as I know, there's never been anything like it in the planet. I mean, the information that is coded in us is also coded in the galaxies, and it's being uncoded. I mean, you've had so much to do with it. Again, I mean, patterns of connection are being found and utilized by the human species in ways that are mythic, even though they may also be cybernetic. And I see all these kids with their transcendental thumbs, you know, texting each other. What are they doing? I mean, dear old Teilhard would have been stunned, the neospheric texting by these chapped thumbs. And maybe, you know, out of the DNA, we are being brought out of our the junk DNA that is 95% of us, and that is actually there, and we're being bootstrapped into a culturally validated, rapidly operating new forms of codes that are allowing the evolution to proceed at a rate so fast that the transformation is taking place essentially in our lifetimes. And I think that our work as practitioners of the practices, as evocateurs of the sacreds, as midwives of a soul, that we exist to show the many ways and the many cultures and the many mythic codings, the mythic DNA, through which the oversoul of being has been calling history toward itself across the dimensions for 20, 30,000 years. And it indicates the excitement and the urgency of this extraordinary time of radical singularity. And, I mean, it's an opportunity. I mean, naturally, the thrill and the exhilaration is matched by the terror, the absolute sheer terror before this unknown emergent or the dimly remembered known. And so here we are, the millennia gestated God seeds, being called into the dispensation for which we've been prepared, and we are scared to life. And necessarily then, every one of our prejudices are rising, and we see it in the antagonism to those things that bring us to the gnosis, the exploration of our deeper realities, the probing of the frontiers of mind and consciousness within our own and other cultures, the harvesting of the spiritual meta-technologies of time and history. And here we are in sheer radical homeostasis with our Wall Street one percenters holding on to business as usual in the face of this overwhelming change. And there's just simply more and more reality at hand, some of which is inside of ourselves, some which is deployed in the world outside of ourselves, but all is affected by the relationship between ourselves and this deeper relationship to deep nature. So finally, I would have to say that we find ourselves at present in the midst of the most massive shift of perspective humankind has ever known. And many feel lost. We have lost our cognitive, our emotional, our psychological bearings in space and time, in culture and context. And we seem to lack the cohesive story that could tell us who we are, where we came from, where we're going. Why? Because when story is present, it sustains and it shapes our emotional attitudes. It provides us with life purposes, and it energizes our everyday acts. It provides both context and the momentum that comes from meaning. And clearly, both personally, collectively, we are in need of our perception of a new story. What is it? Who's going to tell it? I mean, does it come as a collective knowing, or will some rare individual such as yourself can? And maybe you are the one who's telling it. I mean, catch the inspiration. Bring it forth. And perhaps this worldwide Occupy movement is key to this emerging new story. How can we invite a new story where, in spite of lostness and radical change, there is still the possibility of a release so profound that deeper structures of consciousness are tapped in both psyche and society, and a new pattern of connection emerges? I mean, this is the time of the prophetic moment. This is the time of the annunciation of a new myth and the beginning, I think, of a new culture. And I think that we need to think of ourselves as mindful agents of this great transition. I mean, angels in curious costumes, the infinite playing the selfing game. I think that's what the infinite does for fun. And through that, to participate in this great dramatic play at this strange little corner of the galaxy, we need our practices. So those are a few of my thoughts this morning.
Well,
quite a tour de force. course. Thank you, Gene. Yes, Ken, please.
Yeah, that's just beautiful, Gene. I mean, an absolutely brilliant overview, and it hits on so many points, just right on the head. It is this transcendence in jump time, and I agree with you that whatever else it is, and we are still trying to figure out what the heck it is unprecedented in all of history. All of the transformations that humankind has gone through, many of them have been profound, of course, but there's something about what is happening now that just hasn't happened before.
Yes.
And I want to talk a little bit about that transformation, that vacuum, which is the ground of all being. It's truly extraordinary the way that it is coming into play. And as Terry points out, quote, on crucial global issues ranging from the environment to the economy, we are facing challenges that require a whole new level of awareness, cooperation, and courage to address successfully. Must we wait for our governments to get their act together, or can each of us play a role in bringing about meaningful changes starting right now? And the answer, I believe, is that not only can each of us play a role in global transformation, but that we must. It's up to, in a sense, each and every individual to engage the higher, wider, and deeper levels of growth and evolution, thus leading the world into its own desperately needed liberation. But what actually is the real nature of this transformation? How do we know what it involves, and how can we engage it? Thanks to the worldwide research over the past few decades, we now have a fairly detailed maps of consciousness that lay out the states and stages available to human beings and their transformation. And the first thing that we've learned is that human consciousness possesses at least two major central components: structures of consciousness and states of consciousness. Both these components undergo growth, evolution, and transformation. By studying maps of these components and then practicing what they show us, each of us can successfully engage our own transformation to higher and universally available states and structures of consciousness. So let's start briefly with structures of consciousness, also known as levels or stages. In their growth and development, humans have available numerous developmental lines, also sometimes called multiple intelligences, made famous by Howard Gardner. These developmental lines include items like cognitive intelligence, emotional intelligence, moral intelligence, kinesthetic intelligence, spiritual intelligence. Now, although these developmental lines are each quite different from the others, one thing they have in common is that they all develop to the same levels of complexity, or the same developmental levels. It's like 10 paths going up the side of a mountain. The view going up the north side is quite different than the view going up the south side, which is different from the view up the east side, and that, of course, is different from the west side view. So these paths shouldn't be confused with each other or described in terms of each other. But they do have one thing in common, that they all move upwards through the same altitude. So you can say, for example, at this point in development, the north side view and the south side view are each at 3,000 feet, or the east and west path are now both at 7,000 feet. As all the various paths begin to reach the top, the person begins to experience various states of unity or non-duality, where the various paths come together in states of unity consciousness, giving a profound sense of oneness, of freedom, of liberation, of fullness. But what are these levels of altitude or levels of complexity or levels of consciousness like? Numerous researchers have approached this question differently, with different models and different research. One of the earliest and simplest models of these developmental levels is that of Jean Gebser, which basically were called, from the lowest to the highest, archaic to magic to mythic to rational to pluralistic and integral. And humanity on the whole has so far evolved from archaic to magic to mythic to rational, and has recently moved into the pluralistic or postmodern stage, and stands right now on the edge of the next and incredibly important stage, the integral. And this is the stage that we are facing now and that we are attempting to understand, and that is both so extraordinarily important and extraordinarily mysterious. Each of these levels of altitude are marked by different characteristics, one of the most important being how many perspectives it can take. Each stage of development or evolution is marked by transcend and include. Each stage moves beyond or transcends its previous stage, yet includes or embraces it as well. Organisms transcend and include cells, which transcend and include molecules, which transcend and include atoms, which transcend and include quarks. It's the same with human development levels. Magic is egocentric or has a first-person perspective. It can only be aware of the first-person or the I view. Mythic transcends and includes that, adding a second-person perspective, possessing both I and you perspectives, or we. It's ethnocentric. Rational adds a third-person perspective, resulting in objective, scientific, world-centric perspectives. Pluralism adds a fourth person, and thus sees that there isn't only one culture that is correct, but that multiple cultures bring multiple truths. Now, all of these developmental levels together are often referred to as first tier, because each one of them thinks that its views and its views alone are real. So tribal magic and religious myths and modern science and postmodern multiculturalism are all at each other's throats in unending culture wars. But then there occurs what Claire Graves referred to as a monumental leap in meaning, namely the emergence of the integral levels, also known as second tier. Here, the partial truths of all previous levels are explicitly included and embraced, and we arrive at the first truly comprehensive, inclusive, or integrated levels in all of humankind's history. We stand today on the edge of these integral levels, a truly extraordinary, unique, and unbelievably wondrous stage of human evolution, global in its reach, universal in its outcome, all-embracing in its nature. It adds fifth-person perspective, and thus transcends and includes the first through the fourth-person perspectives of the previous levels, which is what makes it so inclusive and all-embracing in its form. Obviously, the integral levels are the ones that we want to aim for and to transform to. How can we do this? Robert Kagan, famous Harvard developmentalist, gives us a key. He says, in development, the subject of one level becomes the object of the subject of the next level. So individuals start out identified with a magic structure. That's their self or subject. At the next stage, they disidentify with that magic subject and identify with the mythic level, which becomes their new self or subject. And the magic can now be seen as an object. It can be seen or observed, which it couldn't be when the self was identified with it. Then, at the next stage, the self identifies with the rational, disidentifies with the mythic, making the mythic an object of the new subject, the rational. And so it goes, with the subject of one stage becoming the object of the subject of the next. Put differently, each stage can take an added perspective by transcending and including the previous perspectives. So the key to growth in these structures of consciousness is to increase the perspectives one can take, both inwardly and outwardly. Inwardly, this means practicing introspection and inward-gazing attention. This can be done by actively practicing looking within, becoming aware of one's present self or subject, and thus making it an object. In other words, transcending and including it. Outwardly, it means taking the role of other, putting yourself in other people's shoes, and trying to see the world through their eyes, or as we say, walking a mile in their shoes. Both of these practices, inward and outward, help make your present subject an object of a yet higher subject, thus increasing your perspective-taking capacity and the depth and height of your consciousness, moving you closer and closer to integral or truly global and inclusive awareness. So there it is. The key to transformation of structures of consciousness is the increasing capacity to take multiple perspectives. And that is part of what we're facing right now, is extraordinary influx of a massive number of different perspectives. And how we fit all of those together, how we create these new stories for ourselves, how we fashion new dreams for humanity on the verge of this transformation. That's part of what we're all questioning. That's part of what these issues are all about. Now, the next and equally important transformational development involves states of consciousness. And this is where spirituality particularly enters the scene. Because structures of consciousness, or multiple intelligences, are how we grow up. But states of consciousness are how we wake up. Growing up being structures and waking up via states are the secret key to overall transformation. As for states, the great meditative and contemplative world traditions usually give four or five major states of consciousness. The waking state, sleeping state, deep dreamless sleep, the witnessing state, and the unity or non-duality. The point is, at birth, a person's wakefulness, with a capital W, or their big mind, their true self, their ultimate self, is identified with the waking state. As one takes up meditation or other spiritual paths, one's identity begins to shift from waking or gross states, marked by their material objects, to dream or subtle states, marked by illumination and visions and thoughts, to deep sleep or causal states, marked by the very subtlest objects to emerge in awareness, upon which gross and subtle objects all depend, to pure witnessing, the observing self, the true self, marked by radical emptiness and an unshakable sense of I am-ness. And finally, to pure unity or non-duality, marked by the simple suchness or isness or thusness of everything that is arising moment to moment. With each shift in identity, from gross ego to subtle soul, to causal formlessness, to witnessing true self, the ultimate unity, one's identity becomes both less and more. Less in that there are fewer states in which consciousness can be limited to, and more in that there are more states it can identify with, moving from the small, finite, pitiful, skin-bound ego to the divine soul, the causal infinite, to the ultimate empty witness, to radical unity or infinite non-duality, which is one with literally the entire cosmos. It's one with the infinite all. Discovering that infinite supreme identity is ultimate enlightenment or awakening, a pure self-liberation free of all limits, bounds, pain, and suffering. This is why states of consciousness are involved in how we wake up. So what is the basic practice here? We saw that with structures of consciousness, it's taking perspectives. With states of consciousness, although there are many, essentially it's mindfulness, or living in the timeless now, the pure present. Basically, each deeper or higher state is closer to the timeless, eternal present. And thus, the more you can live in the present, the closer you are to the supreme identity, which knows only the timeless present. Paraphrasing Wittgenstein, if we correctly take eternity to mean timelessness, not everlasting time, then eternal life belongs to those who live in the present. The more you live in the timeless now, the more your consciousness moves from gross to subtle to causal to witnessing to non-dual suchness or unity. Upon discovering this non-dual suchness, you realize that it is a timeless state you are not really discovering for the first time, but rather have been living in from the very beginning. You, your fundamental I am-ness that you can feel right now, your basic observing self that's fully aware right now, has always been living in the unborn, undying, and timeless eternal state. And its realization is simply walking through Zen's gateless gate. On this side of enlightenment or realization, it looks like there's a gate you need to pass through in order to find your timeless and self-liberated true self. But as you pass through it and turn around and look back, you can find no trace of a gate at all. You've always been living in timeless eternity. Everything else was an illusion. This is why Zen masters call what they're doing selling water by the river, selling you techniques to discover your real, ultimate, timeless, true self when you are really surrounded by it, freely given, always present, fully flowing, and all you have to do is look. Clearly, our ultimate goal is to combine integral structures of consciousness with enlightened states of consciousness, thus discovering a radical, infinite, eternal, timeless consciousness or true self, the one and only one in the entire cosmos, one self, one heart, one spirit, one reality. As Erwin Schrödinger, the co-founder of modern quantum mechanics, put it, consciousness is a singular, the plural of which is unknown. And it is with this integral, unified, enlightened, non-dual, all-inclusive, all-embracing, one and only consciousness that you can begin to approach global problems in ways that actually help, not hurt. You can begin to help heal the planet, not break it further. I would even say don't even think about working in the world until work on yourself has substantially evolved. You'll just contribute to the brokenness of the world otherwise. Rather, find your whole self and then be able to transform the whole world. Or better, work on both at once. But never forget that without inner transformation, outer transformation is blind and guided by a love of wisdom that will sooner or later boomerang, causing more damage in the long run. So combining both is what we are looking for, and that, of course, involves the world of practice, and that is one of the things that we're here to talk about as well. As for this transformation, though, this shift to second tier is a transformation the likes of which has truly never occurred in humanity's history, because all of the previous transformations involved stages that felt their view was the only correct view in existence. And yet these integral or systemic or second tier stages believe that all stages have some true but partial elements. And so we are on the edge of, for the first time in history, a genuinely inclusive state. And the implications of that are radical. We've never had this before. We don't know what it would be like to wake up in a culture that included all other states of being. And instead of simply thinking that my state is right and everybody else's is wrong or confused. And so at the edge of that awakening to that truly all-embracing, all-inclusive state, we are indeed facing something that humankind has never faced before. And it promises to be a transformation, the likes of which we have never seen before. And those of us, meaning all of us on this particular call, are ones in whom this transformation has started to occur. We've started to find an attraction to all-inclusive states. We've started to be pulled towards all-embracing realities. And so we, of course, are open to dozens and dozens and dozens of new theories and new ideas and new perspectives. And as our perspectives grow, we include more and more and more of the cosmos in our own identity. And that is the edge of evolution that we are standing on right now. And it is indeed unprecedented, this rather extraordinary vacuum that we are all headed for.
Beautiful. Thank you, Ken.
You bet.
Well, I think for my orienting statement, what I'd like, I can't add a thing at the level of these beautiful statements that each of you have set forth. I think perhaps what I can contribute is to speak to the human opportunity of an individual who's living in the midst of the beautiful and terrible limitations of a human life, endeavoring to be conscious and to grow and to practice in ways that have integrity and continuity. In the midst of these enormous perspectives, these enormous possibilities and opportunities that you have sketched forth, the course that everyone listening to this call has been involved with is a rich laying out of the daily practice, the moment-to-moment practice, the context of intentionality and purpose, the engagement of specific projects that are milestones, the unification of our urge toward actualization and our impulse to serve something greater than ourselves. And with these big perspectives in view, this cultivation of our own consciousness and our own action is, on the one hand, we may in moments feel tremendously inspired, tremendously uplifted by the size and scope of what's possible for us right now. The fact that we are the lucky ones who've been born into a moment in which we are in jump time, where everything really is potentially transforming, where this momentous leap into a new stage of human consciousness is upon us, such that what happens in our lifetimes matters both in terms of the evolution of consciousness and culture and in terms of the emergencies on the planet. That how we behave, we the the humanity dominating this thin biosphere on this beautiful, wet, rare planet, we have an opportunity to participate in a process that has not just historical but evolutionary significance. So this can be inspiring, but it can also be intimidating. We can, and many people often do, feel like this discussion of the bigger perspectives and possibilities seems pretty highfalutin. They come back to their world and their lives, and they still have to make the mortgage payment or the rent. They still have to deal with very ordinary human responsibilities. There's still crabgrass growing up between the cracks in the sidewalk leading to the front door. There's so much that is pulling on us. We're living in a time in which our attention is distracted 18 ways from Sunday. We have emails and voicemails and cell phone texts and all kinds of things vying for our attention. Everybody's behind on something. The hurtling pace of our lives is tending to bifurcate or just plain fragment our attention and our ability to be feelingly present and embodied. And what often then looms is a sense of overwhelm. Gosh, I can't even live my life with the excellence I want to. I'm behind on or overwhelmed by or stressed by all kinds of very ordinary things. These big perspectives are inspiring, but how can I make a difference? And I think the framing of this inspiring big picture that enables me and the students I've talked with intimately to relate to it in the most healthy possible way is to recognize that we are making something up as we go along right now, and that the ordinary human choices that countless individuals are making, in which we actually do make subject object, in which we actually do wake up and grow up, in which we actually do step forward into this unsustainable, out-of-balance pattern of human life and behavior with a kind of nobility of spirit that's willing to endure the insults and even the potentially depressing, degrading impact of all of that, with a kind of courage and willingness to be as true as we can be, to be as awake as we can be, to be as loving as we can be, as present, as good, true, and beautiful as we can be, to bring that humor and humility forward again and again and again in very concrete and practical ways. Sometimes by embracing the form of a practice like everyone has been engaging together in this course, but very often discovering ourselves challenged in ways we never could have expected, and discovering that the form of being good, true, or beautiful is asking something original of us. It's always an original act. That in each new moment, what is it, if faced with the particular dynamic of that moment, to be a presence of awake intelligence, care, and to really show up? Sometimes that asks for tremendous insight and clarity, penetrating the frames of reference that otherwise would draw us into a kind of somnolent consensus trance. Sometimes it requires courage. Sometimes it requires a kind of humility. Very often it requires us to get off it. And this willingness to honor the difficult dynamic of being alive in a moment in which we can have intuitions that are almost unlimitedly vast, and very often realities or circumstantial moments in which we're dealing with apparently very challenging specific limitations, that to appreciate and honor the challenge of that bigness and smallness simultaneously a part of our experience, and to honor and therefore bring our very best to the seemingly insignificant moments, to therefore consecrate our moment-to-moment living, our process of every breath, such that we really do see moment to wake up, seize each moment to grow up, seize each moment to make a contribution, and then recognize that we do have an opportunity for leadership. Whether or not we apparently look like leaders on the outside, no leader arises in a vacuum. And the person with tremendous responsibilities whose decisions affect the lives of hundreds or thousands of people, or millions of people, still shows up in the context when after contacts with perhaps servants or family members or people who might not outwardly seem to have much power, might seem to have very little influence. But if that if those other people are showing up in their lives with a kind of courage or good-heartedness or just loving presence, those are the influences, the cultural surround, that makes it possible for that leader to notice, here, this janitor is meeting the challenge of his wife's cancer and his difficult work schedule and my staying late and keeping him beyond what he had expected with a kind of kindness and respect and yet a kind of dignity. I can bring that dignity, that kindness, that respect to this difficult decision in which I have to face up to a board or to a shareholders panel or to whatever other challenges they are, government regulations. I can bring a different kind of integrity. I can bring a different kind of creativity to this moment. And it's the little ways in which we're inspiring one another, in which we're actually stitching the very fibers of a different, more responsible, more aligned, more loving, true, free, awake, good, and beautiful human species. So it's in this way that I most feel in contact with the theme that was stated for this panel, how practitioners will transform our world. And I'm curious, you know, presencing this more, say, ordinary framing in the context of these bigger and really inspiring pictures that each of you have brought forth, Jean and Ken. Jean, what would you add to what I just had to say in terms of speaking to the ordinary moments of life of those who are listening to us now?
Well, I think the ordinary moments of life are almost hologrammatic for each of us, that we all participate in the immensity of ordinariness, you know, and that we are not encapsulated bags of skin dragging around dreary little egos, but that we are organism environments. We are collectively involved. But you began to speak about this whole issue of how to bring practice into the world and time. And I'm reminded, of course, in Plato's Republic, where he talks about the education of the philosopher king, which, as I recall, involves a mathematica, you know, understanding pattern, relationship, a gymnastica, a beautiful body, musica, so that you could really follow the rhythms of becoming, and then dialectica, I mean, the way that we can really posit the great issues of mind and nature and self and others and good and evil, and in our conversation, in our dialogue, find our way through. And what are the equivalents of today's, you know, because I have to work with leadership at every level, from, you know, presidents of the United States to people who push the broom in their leper colony. But I find it that often the same problems are universal. I used to pull out an old chestnut of mine and say that too many leaders around the world have been trained to be white males of the year 1926. You know, they've not been trained in terms of who and what they are and what is possible, and the world is suffering enormously because of this. So one of the things that I've done in my work is to try to bring my philosophical and psychological background to bear upon social shifts, and created something called social artistry, human development in the light of social change. Now, the social artist is one who brings something of their own inward work, and it requires a great deal of inward work in ways very similar to what both of you have been saying, to bear upon this extension of sensibility, to bear upon these outward forms. So the social artist is one who is trained to not only move comfortably between cultures, I mean, capable and of understanding and honoring another's belief systems and cultural styles and tribal and national stories and rituals. But this requires, in terms of human development, high sensory development, a polyphrenic nature, and a willingness to keep plunging deeper in order to tease out the elements of what I refer to as the emerging story. She learns to see trends and the emergence of new patterns from apparent chaos, and to suspend the particular narrow focus points of view. Now, when I train people around the world, and also in our own countries, I find that I find a kind of generalized agenda, which I've gone way beyond, but in its most basic form, it is sensory development, psychological development, mythic and narrative and symbolic development, and ultimately spiritual development, and they can be happening simultaneously, because in terms of our own sensory field. By the way, I came to this many years ago when I was about 20, 21, and I had the only legal supply of LSD in New York City, which allowed made me very popular and allowed me to take depth probings of the psyche, of the amplification of the psychodynamic processes, and it, you know, saved me probably a lot of years. Then I went to psychological school and worked on rats, and I saw a great divide there. But the thing that one finds in one's sensory development is that as you develop the internal senses, the inner proprioceptives, inner sensing, seeing, being, hearing, and everybody has a particular form. Mine is kinesthetic and auditory. My late husband's was acute internal imagery. But as you develop these internal proprioceptors, you find that you can, your outer receiving set, as you will, also increases because you're opening up the real estate of the mind and brain system to the sensory images. And then you find that you drop a problem in, and it's like a seed crystal in a supersaturated solution, and that creative ideas and perspectives much more easily arise, and so that you can take this extended sensory field to bear upon almost any issue, and it opens up in its multiple perspectives. So that's something that I have found very, very valuable in teaching, as well as psychophysical restructuring, because whether I use sort of Feldenkrais types of things, and my late husband, of course, was really quite expert in this, because as you extend the sense of the physical systems, you also extend the kinesthetic sense, and with the kinesthetic sense, you find that you are then able to learn skills much more quickly, because you begin to bring in the sensory images of optimal performance or optimal template, and then you are able to circuit or wire them, if you will, into the physical exercise or physical performance or even just physical way of being, that so that one part of the brain-mind system trains the other. And then we get to the psychological systems. You know, we are polymorphous, perverse in our persona. Ego is but one image among the multiple images of the psyche. And we find that we have access to an entire crew, you know, as it were, of different persona. I mean, I use myself as an exemplum for cerebrum. I hate to write. I hate it. I am phobic. Jean cannot write. But Jean happens to be a very good cook. And the reason I'm a good cook is because my mother, Maria Annunziata Serafina Graziella Fiorina Perpetua Todaro, was born in Syracuse, Sicily, marries Jack Houston of Texas. They hate each other's food. To keep them together, I became the world's first fusion cook, making chicken fried polenta, you know. So I have kept this going, and, you know, really being a serious cook. As a cook, I literally have no blocks at all. So when I write, I literally have to become a cook and cook up images and stir in the melange of associations and the spice of different ideas. And then I am not blocked. And I find that when people have access to the range of persona that they have, and they often find many, and begin to develop them, they don't have the usual blocking systems or the usual inhibitory systems that come from their personal history, that we have a way of transcending history by accessing the natural polyphrenia, you know, of the human psyche. Now, both of these things that I've just named, the extended sensory systems, the extended persona, systems of persona, I find with the many indigenous cultures that I've worked with, which is also a question I'm going to ask you a little later in our conversation, Ken, because the same problem I had with Abe Maslow. When I was very young, I used to, didn't know any better, and I used to challenge him, and he was a good friend. And I'd say, what do you mean hierarchy? What do you mean hierarchy? I've seen the poorest of people rise to the highest form of individuation and invention.
Right.
You know, what do you mean hierarchy? And the same thing, I mean, I find that the Gebser and the Claire Graves and the Don Beck, and I, you know, I have these big arguments with Don Beck about this, is that, you know, we can talk about the emergence from earlier stages, but I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I agree in principle, but in practice, having worked at some of the most basic levels of Australian Aborigines and finding them really at very early what we would consider magical stages and mythical stages with the living in the dream time, but they also have the capacity for the most exquisite integral ways of knowing.
Right.
So that's another argument, not an argument, but something I'd like to pursue with you.
Let me just briefly respond to that. Okay.
Yes.
One of the things that I have found is that the earlier stages of human development in many cases excelled in states of consciousness and in ways that we, as evolution continued, for some reason tended to lose track of, whereas their capacity with structures of consciousness wasn't as developed. So if you look at things that structures of consciousness are in charge of, for example, like moral development, and you look at then something like slavery, you find that every form of human culture, including the indigenous tribes, had slavery until you get to the Western Enlightenment. And then with the emergence of the post-conventional stages of development that saw all human beings as equal, regardless of race, color, sex, or creed, slavery was outlawed for the first time in history in all 100 industrial rational cultures. So while we're doing well in structures, you then look at how are the states of consciousness doing? How are they doing in terms of access to spiritual experiences or peak experiences, stuff like that? And the answer was crappy. But just absolutely doing horrid. Would any indigenous child could surpass the typical mature adult of Western cultures at that point? And so it's kind of a mixed bag. And what we're trying to do is find a way to include growth and development in all of these, in structures and in states, wherever the actual practice comes from. And of course, in most of the meditative states of consciousness, those all come from the great contemplative traditions around the world, most of which are, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 years old. And we find virtually none of it in the modern West and in development of the West. So what we can do, though, is that if we actually do empirical studies on people's development, we find that the move through some of these structures does occur. We can measure it, and it occurs over and over. It's something that can be done. And that's encouraging because it means that we can take up certain practices that will allow us to develop from pre-rational to rational to trans-rational structures. What we have to add, what we're absolutely miserable on, are states of consciousness. And virtually every indigenous culture has a polyphasic
culture. They have multiple states of consciousness, each of which is honored, each of which does something different, from states of consciousness in the hunt to states of consciousness in vision quest, and so on. And for a series of just bizarre reasons, Western culture threw virtually all of that out and settled on one state of consciousness, which is, as Alan Watts put it, sort of what the world looks like on a bleak Monday morning on the way to work.
That's true. I'm thinking also
that's the that's the state of consciousness that we're stuck with. And this is horrible. I mean, the human potential movement was about, you know, not only doing well in structures, but breaking out into all of these multiple states.
It's
and, I mean, your work was pioneer.
That in 1787, I just had a vision of the tall ships arriving on from England, arriving in 1787, I think it was, on the shores of Australia, where a high-tech, low-souled culture met a low-tech, high-souled culture.
Exactly.
They didn't know what to do, and they just trashed it. And this is what has done. So, I mean, I'm very grateful to you for making this distinction. And, of course, the issues are now that we have the harvest of the genius of the spiritual meta-technologies,
right,
how to inspire, input, evoke these states of consciousness into the general sensibility. And that, of course, is a huge, huge issue. But I find that when you do so, then you have that next stage. You have another narrative that becomes possible. But, you know, when you look at the hero's journey, there's very little in it of the narrative of states of consciousness. It's just...
Well, that's
fighting
that's
one damn thing after another in the road of trials. And finally,
right,
he gets the Hieros Gamos, the holy marriage, and the atonement with the Father, and supposedly he has had enough experience to go back and become the master of two worlds. And that
right,
just isn't true, because he has not become... And this is where, again, my great arguments with great men, Joe Campbell and I used to fight it out for years about this, because he said there was no heroine's journey. And I insisted that there was, but it dealt with states of consciousness rather than
right,
states of the embattled young hero battling his own toxicities. You know.
And I absolutely agree. And you know, what I see the human potential movement at is in so many ways is the influx of the multiple states of consciousness and multiple practices and techniques for inducing them. And I mean, that's what Esalen was all about. That you were a pioneer in it. So many of your books, from The Possible Human, which is a great title, on down the line, were exactly how we're saying, look, we have these other potentials. We have a possible human that we can become that we are categorically overlooking. And this is catastrophic, because these are some of the greatest potentials in humankind's history, not to mention the fact that they're the core of waking up, of actually contacting ultimate reality, of contacting our true self, of what the Sufis call the supreme identity. And you're overlooking all of that? That's insane. That's the definition of an insane culture. And so that's where some balance between these is what I think now is the real unprecedented point that we're at, and why it's so unusual and extraordinary is that now we can do, yes, fine, we can have structures that will outlaw slavery and that will introduce women's rights and so on. We can get those in place. But we can also work with all of these states, including the ones that you just gave a run through, from sensory to psychological to spiritual. Introduce
Through the narrative and symbolic.
Through the exactly.
Because that condenses the totality of it in a doable symbol. You know,
well put.
Coded symbol.
So what happens when we do that? It's an entirely different world. We have never been in a culture where that could happen. And that's what's so exciting to me about the possibilities of you know, where we stand today.
Well, you know, what I've been trying to do, Ken, and for many years now, because I've been in all these different cultures and sent out by the UN to help them fulfill the Millennium Development Goals, which they are not about to do with the same state of consciousness. So what I do is, by having them find their deep narrative, For example, if I'm in India, we work with the Ramayana or the,
yeah.
the life of Gandhi and similar things with different cultures.
Because
they will go further and faster and deeper as you weave different processes and activations of consciousness within the structure of the narrative myth. And yet we find that if they are activating these different kinds of states of consciousness, then they, in different capacities, they bring this expanded sensorium and psychological dimensionality and story to bear upon a Millennium Development Goals, women's rights, the ecological issues. They bring an expanded beingness to these issues, and they come out with collectively, because, you know, I may work with 100 people at a time.
Sure,
they come
sure.
out with very different solutions, which then they have a passion for the possible, so to speak, and
right.
then can bring them into pragmatic manifestation. But
that's a very important discovery.
Yeah.
That's a very important discovery, and that's exactly, you know, part of tapping into all of these capacities that human beings have. Because I think one thing that you and I could certainly agree on is that there's never been a culture that had access to all of these potentials that we're talking about. That's something new.
That certainly is true.
And that's what's outrageous. That's what's so, you know, both wonderful and frightening and exciting. And that is, I think you and I would also agree, that's what's kind of lacking in this whole talk of global transformation and whatnot, is that it's just not inclusive enough. That the people that talk global transformation either have, you know, one structure of consciousness that it might be a new paradigm structure, and that's what they're pushing, or they have one state of consciousness, and they're pushing that, and that's going to change everything. And I think you and I would find both of those just desperately limited. And we need to really tap into this full bag of the possible human and bring all of these capacities forward.
I think what is happening is that we have, you know, cultures. It's like watching a speeded up movie of strange multicultural mitosis, you know, and their strangers born. I mean, cultures thousands of miles apart that had gestated in the womb of preparatory time for thousands of years, suddenly
right.
cheek by jowl. And I think what we're
right.
seeing is, in the force of the meeting, a new genesis is occurring. I mean, occasionally and more rapidly now, a melding of genes, but more often a mingling of previously divided worlds, which when thrown together are undergoing a sea change into something rich and strange. I mean, and what is resulting is
Absolutely.
Not merely a hyphenated amalgam, Afro-Asian rock music or cyberpunk art, but rather hybrid sounds for hybrid cells, which is a kind of malleable, syncretic fusion that is generating its own cultural matrix. And I think the complexity of this not yet definable culture is providing sufficient stimulus to call forth latencies that have been just sitting around waiting for their time. I mean, latencies in the human brain, mind, cultural, spiritual systems that were never needed before, like the bacteria learning to breathe rather than die when the culture of oxygen came in. I mean, the breakdown of the membrane is not merely cultural fusion. It's like a joining together of the geographies of mind and body that had never touched before. I mean, weaving synapses and sensibilities to create people who are perhaps being fused into a world mind with its tremendous treasures, its empowering capacities. And so here we say a quickening charge of cultural mitosis.
Exactly.
Well, that's a very beautiful image, Gene, and I'd like to ask you to bring that down. So, okay, we're alive here in this time in which this kind of breakdown of membranes is taking place, and we, to some degree, are spontaneously participating in it. Are there ways to intentionally participate in it, to practice with it in a way that help to contribute to the health of the system? Because there certainly is a sense that the chaos of all these collisions potentially leads to breakdown rather than breakthrough. And what is it that we do to practice with it such that we contribute to the health and the coherence of the system?
Maybe it's the Sangha. Maybe it's back to the Sangha, only we call it a teaching-learning community. I mean, Margaret Mead on her deathbed said to me, "Forget everything I've been teaching you about working with governments and bureaucracies." I said, "Now you tell me this." Now she said, "Yeah." And she found it funny. And she said, I've become an anthropologist on my own dying." She said,
"Oh,
wow.
And
I see that if we're going to green and survive our world, it is a question of people getting together and teaching learning communities all over these pods where they have a, you know, they grow in body, mind, and spirit, and there's got to be good food and no telephones. But she talked about this. She said, "Gene, when the time is ready, you go out and do that." And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I will." You know, it's in my own small world trying to do that. But it is, I think, and I think this is what you both, you, Terry, and you, Ken, are really providing. You're providing the basic organic nutriments for ongoing teaching learning communities.
Right.
But without the strictures of very fixated ideologies, but with these open-ended possibilities.
And I think it's exactly right that, in a sense, human history, in part, has been growing towards the time that this type of consciousness would be desperately needed. If you look at today's problems, for the first time in history, most of our wicked problems are global. It means they're transnational, and if any one nation, for example, if we look at global warming, if any one nation, if the United States, cut back entirely on its carbon production, that wouldn't affect the problem. Nations all over the planet have to change. So not only are our problems global, economy and ecology and so on, we're starting to reach states of consciousness that are global and that reach into all of these potentials that weren't necessarily needed or called upon in previous history.
That's right.
But now are absolutely desperately needed if we're going to get through this. And it's very, very interesting that both our problems are global and our growing consciousness is now global. And the two are, in a sense, coming together in a very auspicious way that gives me some sort of optimistic hope that we can get through the global problems by drawing on our global potentials.
Well, you know, Ken, you've sometimes said that you thought that the vectors of disorder were so strong that the opportunities for transcendence would probably be created by the windows of opportunity opened up by terrible, catastrophic dislocations. And,
well,
you know, I'm curious as to how you'd connect that to what we've just been discussing.
Yeah, I think it's a very complex issue. I don't think it's just that catastrophic breakdowns are going to automatically pull forth from us all of these positive potentials. In many cases, what happens when you get catastrophic breakdown is you get regression. You get societies that really fall apart in some of the most basic means necessary to survive. I think here what we are facing is a time where we are going to be facing some cataclysmic problems, and these are going to be catalysts for us reaching into new types of solution, new types of human beings, and new types of consciousness that will be required. And in some ways, this will be bottom-up, grassroots movements, but in some ways, I think, more so even than a lot of changes in the past, we also, this is a point where we need real leadership at the top. That's going to step in and say, "Okay, look, we need to start looking at some of these things, and we can't just leave it to grassroots movements, although those are going to be important, but we're also going to need really visionary leaders that will step forth and say, look, we have to have not just exterior changes, we have to have interior changes. We have to really look at the possible human from both inside and outside. And it'll no longer do to just approach from one angle or the other. we need a truly integral approaches, truly all-sided, or I think we're just going to continue to kind of spin our wheels on this. And we certainly, in many ways, are just spinning our wheels so far.
Gene, I want to invite you to reflect on that in terms of this, in terms of this so-called race between consciousness and catastrophe, and the potentials for breakdown and breakthrough to combine in ways that might be regressive or potentially transformative.
Well,
what are your hopes, fears, and senses of possibility?
Yeah, well, I think that. I think we're not the only ones minding the store. That's part of it. You know, that if we are going to have a world civilization with high individuation of culture and an emerging planetary culture, which means an emerging new sensibility in our human direction, and that we feel the lure of becoming, that's what I'm seeing as that third force, that lure of becoming. You know, when I work around the world, I find it necessary to work both intraculturally as well as transculturally. And mm-hmm. in my transcultural work, I try to speak to that which is potential in every human being, regardless of the local and cultural conditionings. I might speak to the yearning that I find in everyone. This is a big thing, yearning. It's tremendous, this radical, galloping yearning. I mean, whether it's the person who yearns is a peddling a rickshaw in Delhi or running an oil company in Dallas. And then this is where this practice has come in, to try and offer liberating thought waves. I said thought waves, that's a Jungian slip, but thought waves that launch understanding and motivation and problem solving beyond their constricting cultural and instinctual preconditioning. I mean, in the Platonic dialogue, the Meno, Socrates shows how an uneducated slave understands implicitly the nature of geometry and mathematics, and in some sense, they try to do the same. I mean, using art and story and metaphor to frame a complex array of processes and techniques, I mean, designed to bring forth potentials that are latent in most people. We try to show them that they have natural access to capacities like being able to think with many different frames of mind. I mean, visual, verbal, kinesthetic, subjective, intuitive, logical, mathematics. I mean, capacities that then, as I said, improve the physical use of the body and that enhance memory and writing and creative expression and problem solving. And what I find all over the world is that given education and opportunity, most people are able to make remarkable improvements in their functioning and learn new ways of being in a relatively short period of time. And I find, however, that if anything, this is more true of developing countries, where we find that people seem to be closer to their innate potentials because they've not yet been shuttered by education and social objectives that inhibit and coerce their natural capacities into approved tracks and templates that are going to make them a lot of money. But wherever we've worked, we find that the possible human is just beneath the surface crust of local culture and that consciousness, and that possible society is not far behind. Maybe somewhere in the galaxy there are civilizations that have already broken through and have these solutions. Maybe if we are holograms, we have access to this. I mean, I'd like to think that, but I mean, you get badly objectified when you do say that. I mean, I think of a Hindu woman singing to us at a sweeper colony in Bangladesh, and shining eyes. And I asked her, "What do you want most in the world?" She replied, "I want an education. I want to learn so many things. I want my children to learn. I want to spend my life learning." And in many other cultures, this young woman would be highly educated and pursue a career in lifelong learning. Why not in Bangladesh? And so I think that there is a story emerging that, Terry, that is putting together these hitherto divided and distinguished worlds. And I find that I am ultimately very... I feel good about things. Maybe it's because I travel so much and I'm in so many different situations. but I feel good. I mean, the collapse of old values and beliefs, the desecration of the earth, the animosity between nations, the formidable loss of the old story that told us how to live and where we might be going. This is a time of renaissance. I really believe it. Because when the time is ripe for renovation, that which is needed, I think, will arise from the soul of the world, the cosmic agenda, the depths of ourselves to supply it. I mean, people grow laconic and bored and driven to outrage and hysteria if the impetus to newness and renewal goes too long wanting, too long waiting, as it has. Cultures, as we see, fall into chaos. Economic and psychological depression, as well as violence, rule the day. But a renaissance, a rebirth out of an outmoded or dying or impossible situation, it's when the soul grows and becomes equal to the challenges, indeed becomes able to lift and enlighten and offer new ways of being and doing. And so when you
think
the renaissance, go ahead.
No, go right ahead. Finish, please.
Well, I think that it's during these renaissance eras that maybe we're actually seeing this third force, the mind of the maker, you know,
right,
determining that the time is ready for a major jump in culture and consciousness, and maybe inserting social and psychic enzymes to help affect these transitions.
Right. I couldn't agree more, you know, along with obviously facing all the problems that we're facing. But there is that opening. There is that third way. And putting divided cultures together is just a perfect way to even think about integral. And one of the reasons that I'm, you know, really glad that the postmodern approach has lost some of its grip. Now, there's some very important things about the postmodern approach and philosophies, and I've made a great deal of use of many of them. But the main problem to me about them was their denial that what we're talking about is even possible. There are no human universals. There is nothing that is the same from culture to culture. And even talking about a universal humanity is to impose our set of beliefs on other people. And I think that is so desperately wrong and confused. I think it can happen at lower levels of dominator hierarchies and caste systems and things like that, but that there is also a transrational, transcultural, transnational approach where you start to talk about universals that are not oppressive, but are actualizing our growth potentials. And that this is something that every human being comes with, just like they come with 208 bones and 2 eyes and 2 lungs and 1 heart. And saying that is not oppressive, it's not imperialistic, it's not colonialistic, it's the truth.
Yes.
And that allows us to open ourselves to exactly what you're talking about. And I think that's just what must happen. And frankly, it's the postmodern impetus has really, for the past couple of decades, slowed down that process, and I'm glad to say that it's now itself kind of come to a bit of a grinding halt, and we find more and more and more individuals looking at these possibilities of truly universal potentials and a possible human that is truly, you know, homo universalis and reaches us all and gives us a chance and a hope to find a humanity that can live together on this small planet.
Do you think that the actual growth that we are seeing in the healthiest dimensions of both our Western cultures and the more indigenous cultures are capable in new ways of rising to challenges, because there probably will be certain catastrophes and disasters without everything coming completely unglued.
Yeah.
You know, the road ahead is not simply going to be a sunny, sweet path. There are a lot of challenges ahead. How are we better prepared to work with that uncertainty, and are there particular aspects of our practice that tend to be underemphasized that need more emphasis in order for us to cope better with the actualities of the complex and sometimes bumpy road that likely lies ahead?
I'll just mention one thing briefly, and that is that the educational system that we have really undergo its own transformation, so that we are educating for the possible human. We are educating for the integral human. We are educating for the evolutionary human, and starting to teach practices that you can find in Gene's books, for example, you can find in Omega, you can find in Esalen, and not just the sort of narrow type of intelligences that we've focused on so far. And so by teaching all of these other possible types of awareness and consciousness, and working with kinesthetic and musical and artistic and poetic, whether there's a direct use for those, and there's already a use for it because you become a better human being doing it. But having human beings that are in touch with those potentials are going to be the human beings that will be able to face these problems and will be able to call forth these types of knowledge and these types of potentials that otherwise are just completely gone fallow. And are wasting, and are not even we wouldn't even know how to use them if the demand for them came up. And so I think that the humanity's million year history has given all of its various cultures an enormous amount of potentials and possibilities and knowledge. And what we really have to do now is educate for all of that, is to make all of that available, and get out of that really still very, very narrow and very provincial type of education that we still seem to have.
We're educated for another time, and that's part of the great tragedy of our time. I mean, I have never met a stupid child, but I have met incredibly stupid and mind-diminishing schools. And, when we try to go into these different places and we try to create new schools, one of the things we do is we put art back as central to the curriculum.
Yeah.
Because if a child is dancing and singing and drumming and enacting and dramatizing information, they simply do not fail. They do not fail. And so this is one of the great opportunities that we have. I mean, I'm faced with this question certainly on a weekly basis. People say, well, Gene, it's wonderful what you're talking about in transforming education, and I believe it, but we are just being taught to teach for the test, and music and art is gone, and we're working with these different horrible, horrible bureaucracies. What can we do? So if I go into a third world country, we find that we can work and create new schools, as we did in Bangladesh, with their culture at the center. In the United States or Canada, it is very, very difficult. And what I keep advising people to do is to form their own teacher, the sort of meta-teacher union, where they really talk together about what they can do to help these different children to realize that there's no such thing as a stupid child. And to address the whole system, the whole mind, because I quite agree. I mean, you really have to work from the ground up with children, being taught different ways of knowing and being, and that they're not stupid, ways of thinking in different modalities, as well as awareness, mindfulness, and perhaps even some of the contemplative techniques, getting away with them by saying it's going to help them with their math. But however you do it, if the teachers can do it, then teach after-school programs. I mean, this is critical to accelerate. I mean, you give them, the lure of becoming, that you're going to accelerate in your school if you turn on more parts of your brain mind. And you use quasi-scientific knowledge. I mean, or I'm sorry, not knowledge, but because it's real. You say, we're going to do more neurological wiring of your brain,
right.
And everybody gets very excited.
Right.
But without this, I think that we are in a very, very bad way. One thing I'd like to ask both of you, and that is, how to put this, what is your inspiration? And what inspires you now? What inspires you? I'll put it this way. What do you want to evoke in people? What do you want to ignite for the rest of your lives?
Well, mine is desperately archaic in a certain sense, and it's evoking the good, the true, and the beautiful, and a world in which there is room for all of them, and not a world in which just truth, a particular one type of truth, colonizes all of the others and pushes them out of respectability or even existence, and finding ways that all of the different versions of the good and the true and the beautiful can be brought together and integrated and made part of what we consider the good life. And the thing is, there are indeed practices for each of those. There, the shame about the difficulty you talk about in the States about changing education. The shame is that we really, so many of the things that we have and that we want to implement, we already have. We already know how to do them. The knowledge is out there. The practices are out there. The techniques are out there.
Yes.
And we don't even make use of those. And that just breaks my heart. Because what we really are talking about with using those are ways to introduce the good and the true and the beautiful, and to make those hallmarks of a society where all of those are brought forth in human beings, and where human beings can celebrate and recognize all of those potentials in themselves. And not just, this dry one type of truth only, and the incredibly flatland and flattened world that results. And so I'm still, optimistic about the chance of us doing that. But I'm not naive. Unfortunately, we run into exactly the problems that you talk about, and I think that sort of meta PTA thing is as good an idea as any to get started on some of this. But we desperately do need to get started on it.
Thank you, Gene, for asking this question, and thank you for that response, Ken.
Wonderful.
What really inspires me is actually the building of these communities of practice, because there is something that begins to arise when people recognize deeply that no matter how much we may have embraced inspiring ideas or opened our hearts or entered into higher states or wept our tears and really embraced the good in so many past moments, there is this constant process of self-contraction going on. We are tending always to become the ego and to separate ourselves. And when we do that, we're not trustable. And that what it takes is an ongoing reapplication of ourselves from the heart, from our best intelligence. But it's a kind of, it requires what was talked about in religious languages, repentance and conversion, where we actually turn ourselves beyond that self-contracted activity again and again and again each day. And when we do that, we do that from the heart, and we let ourselves be transparently seen in the doing of that, in the ordeal of not always doing it perfectly, but caring to do it better in each moment, we really become transparent and connected and trustable, and a different kind of communal connection deepens. And I think that is one of the real frontiers of what's happening in our time. That's what I see happening among my students in this course, especially the ones who work especially intimately with one another and with me in the smaller formats, in which there really is a different kind of culture being prototyped, a culture of continual return to practice, continual conversion at the heart, and a recognition that it's never something, no matter how deeply you do it, you never then become someone who's a member of the elect who has done it. No, it's something you need to reenact in each new moment. And the sense that we can be doing that, and that activity is not just a subjective activity, but it's an objective activity, and that by doing that, we obligate ourselves to do it ever more and to do it ever more potently and effectively in relation to others in a way that has a loving and transformative effect on the world. And I think that there is a building, standing wave of coherence in me and in those I'm working with that does feel like it begins to cut some new grooves in the cosmos, as you've put it so beautifully, Ken. And that's what's inspiring and exciting me, and feeling like it really is a potential for part of the newness that our crisis times are obviously calling for.
Mm-hmm. Hear, hear.
That's wonderful. Well, in listening to your wonderful answers, I'm just trying to think myself into what I really want for. And I'm thinking of somebody who's listening on this program now, and I'm going to take a stab at it and try to speak directly to them. In the you. So what do I want to evoke? I want to inspire you to discover the genius of your larval mind. I want you to engage spiritual technologies old and new to explore brave new worlds of the inner continents. I want you to become a superb catalyst. A carrier of new genesis as the world is getting ready to move from chaos to some new order of being. I want you to think in varied postures, given to contemplation, sacred communion, archetypal partnerships to stock your spiritual income so as to have the wherewithal for ethical and creative expenditures necessary to these times. I want to help guide you, as Ken and Terry have, guide you into the spiritual craft of soul-making, one that illumines the journey as well as the art and discipline that leads to spiritual transformation. But it's only with spiritual transformation that this world itself is going to survive and improve. And I want you to understand your double nature. I mean, finite and infinite. You are a God seed planted in a space-time vehicle, and thus always yearning and questing and drawn by the lure of becoming until you will reach a destiny that has perhaps been guiding you all along. And I want you to remember your original birthright, and I want you to commit again and again to following the path that leads you home to who and what you really are. And you know what? I want you to have a sufficiency of intellectual and moral passion to explore new ways of being for body and mind and soul, and with it, the ability to be present to the availability of an unobstructed universe, both within and without. And I want you to carry this illuminating life into the world. And I want you to become a revelation to others, an intellectual and psychological and spiritual beacon, an evocateur of new patterns, new relationships, new discoveries. I want you to bring new mind and new matter to an old world and serve as a catalyst of change and ultimately a pathfinder of deeper realities. That's what I want.
Oh, that's beautiful. As you were saying that, I kept getting this flash of a story that you told in The Possible Human, and I think all of us would agree with the story I'm about to summarize that Gene told so well, and which was so important in your life, and that was the period where you were in college and. You had started out and you were just Miss Wonderful, you know, straight A's and head of the drama club and da, da, da. And then a whole series of just real tragedies happened, and you went through a period where you just really kind of sunk down into those bottomless pits that sometimes we get in and we just can't seem to get out of. And you were in a class, something having to do with Nietzsche's transvaluation of values and whatnot.
Yes.
And you were, your grades had gone to hell. Everything was just about as bad as it could get. You're walking home one day. The professor calls you out and says, Miss Houston. And you're like, what, me? And I said, yes. I have to ask you, could you mind if I ask you a question? And you go, well, sure, why would you want to ask me a question? And he says, well, it's obvious from the things that you say in class that you have a very bright and innovative mind, and I would like to ask you this question. And you went, well, okay. And you had a series then of conversations with this gentleman and completely turned your life around. And you said that really what you're doing to this day is what that gentleman did for you. And it was just simply recognize another human being.
He said to me, it is important for my reflections that I have your reflections.
Isn't that amazing?
Powerful to me.
Isn't that amazing?
There I was about to be thrown out of school for an inadequacy of intellectual equipment. and a year and a half later, I was teaching at that university. I was teaching at Columbia.
Isn't that amazing?
Because he saw me. It was deep darshan, and his seeing me, I could finally see myself and come back to myself.
And beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful, and that's, in so many ways, that's what we're all still trying to do. And if, you know, every human being did that for every other human being, this would indeed be a different planet. But it was a beautiful story, and I just was so touched by your telling it, and so glad for that professor. I kept thinking, well, God bless him, and thank God he was there.
Well, beautiful. Well, I want to... I can see that we could go on all day, that the richness of these brilliant minds and hearts really keeps going and going and going, and yet we've managed to turn 2 hours, make it go by in the blink of an eye. Thank you so much. I want to give each of you a chance to maybe say just a very, you know, brief final words as we say goodbye to everyone. I just want to say that these are deep questions that we will always be holding, and that we've kind of thrown our hearts and minds into this consideration and into this inquiry in new and original and vital ways in this 2 hours, and we will all, us and those listening to us, keep doing this in the time ahead. These are questions that are fruitful and that need, for which we need even better answers as brilliantly as we've answered them now. And so I'm feeling enlivened and inspired and grateful, and it's just been wonderful sharing this space with each of you. Thank you so much. You know, please say anything that you feel moved to say as we finish up.
Jean, please, go ahead.
Well, perhaps under the cover of the dark night and beneath the wasteland of a world that seemingly has ignored its source, something wonderful is happening. I really believe that the Earth herself is weaving a new humanity and a new scenario of what the world may be. And I really find the signs of growth everywhere. And I think today more than ever we have the collective responsibility of holding the possibility of a new story for the Earth while she undergoes her crisis. We need to encourage each other to break through the invisible bubble of hopelessness that keeps us trapped in wastelands of our minds. And I think that with commitment, passion, practice, spiritual practice, and whether whatever it is, be it the via negativa, the form through, that doesn't really mean negative, it means the forms of deep contemplation and meditation, or the via positiva, where we really explore the expansion of our human capacities in the world, and a strong desire to serve, we can also know what we have to support, what we have to do to support those groups, those movements that are working in real ways to green the wasteland in both inner and outer ecology. And I believe that these are the times, and we are the people in the most critical and alarming and alluring time in human history.
Wonderful. I agree that we are on the edge of something quite extraordinary, and not in a Pollyannish way, not in a New Age way, not in the fact that there's a single new paradigm coming in, and that single new paradigm is going to change. Every single person on the planet is going to adopt it, and that's going to transform everything. And it's, and you know, I've I appreciate the good-heartedness behind those stories, but I think it's just a little more complex than that. But I think there's a grain of truth to it. Humanity, in its million-year history, has only gone through around five truly major transformations. We've gone from foraging to horticultural to agrarian to industrial to pluralistic and informational. And we stand now on the edge of the sixth major human transformation. But this one is unlike any that has gone before. And so it's not just sort of a boomer-esque attitude to say that. We really are standing on the edge of a transformation, the likes of which humanity has never seen. And it just one characteristic is that we are moving into an era that, unlike all the previous eras, does not think that it alone has truth, but that all of the previous eras have some degree of truth, and that we need to include all of them in an integrated, holistic, and compassionate way if we are going to have enough information, enough tools, enough knowledge to be able to face some of the truly catastrophic events that are looming on our horizon. But I think the fact that they are looming, I think the fact that we are facing some truly wicked problems, are in some strange sense exactly the catalyst that's going to call forth this new consciousness that is holistic, that is truly inclusive of all of the earlier cultures and all of the different types and ways and means of knowing that human beings have, and that this actual catastrophic possibilities are there, and the only way we'll overcome them is if we awaken to everything that we are possible of being. We truly have to awaken the possible human. And I think that in some wonderfully wacky way, this all fits together. Our problems for the first time are global. Our consciousness for the first time that's emerging is global. And therefore the possibilities for us, for you and me and each of us, in a day-to-day life is global, is universal, is transcendental. And that is also radically unique. And my hope for all of us is that we would have the passion that Gene spoke of to enter in a day-to-day way our world and with Terry work on this self-contracting, which really means the avoidance of relationship and the turning away from the unity that we are invited to live. And with all of those things coming together, it is indeed a very, very delicate and difficult time. But it's also, indeed, the time of probably the most potential and most possibilities that the human race has ever seen. And I think on balance, when all is said and done, we are going to all consider ourselves thankful that we were born in this era. And my hope for all of us is that we can go out of this world leaving it just a little bit more whole than we found it. And I think that would be great.
But you know, Terry and Ken, there is a poem by Christopher Fry that I think sums this all up. A very short poem. It goes, "The human heart can go to the length of God. Dark and cold we may be, but this is no winter now. The frozen misery of centuries cracks, breaks, begins to move. The thunder is the thunder, the flood, the flow, the upstart spring. Thank God, our time is now. Wrong comes up to meet us everywhere, never to leave us till we take the longest stride of soul men ever took. Affairs are now soul-sized. The enterprise is exploration into God. What are you making for? It takes so many thousand years to wake. But when you wake, for pity's sake."
Wow.
Beautiful.
Exquisite. Thank you so much for bringing that in.
Thank you, Jean. Thank you, Ken. Thank you, everyone.
Thank
this
you,
has
Terry.
Been just a
Thank you, Terry.
Wonderful delight.
Okay.
All right. Well,
all right.
Onward and upward, inward and outward, practicing from the heart every step of the way. Have a wonderful day. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye now.